Welcome to the episode number 9 of the Board Game OK podcast, a podcast about board games and the hobby of board gaming, recorded in cold but sunny Helsinki, Finland. I'm your co-host Jonas, and with me is my co-host Luis.
Hello, hello everyone. Happy to have the sun on our backs.
In this episode, we will be discussing the tariff apocalypse and its effect on the industry and us as gamers. But before we get to that, we will talk about Twilight Struggle, All Bridges Burning, Red Revolt and White Card in Finland 1970-1918, and a little bit about Root. Luis, tell us about Twilight Struggle.
Sure thing, sure thing. And I want to preface this review by saying, like, I haven't played the game that much as probably some people that love the game have. So I wanted to also approach these comments or this review as, like, a person that has always wanted to play Twilight Struggle, have played it already several times, but not more than five. And like kind of like approach, like, is it worth it? Is it worth it to keep playing? Is it worth it to invest more time? So I wanted to say that just so that my ignorance about the game doesn't become obvious for the reviewers and a problem. So I wanted just to say what was my approach for this particular review. So anyway, Twilight Struggle is a game from 2005, designed by Ananda Gupta and Jason Matthews. And basically, it's a game about the Cold War, right? Everybody kind of knows that. It's a heavy game, and it was for a long time, I think, number one game of all time in Board Game Geek. For several years, it is a game exclusively for two players, where the one person is playing the United States and one person is playing the USSR. And in general, there are several winning conditions, but the main winning conditions are either victory points at the end of the game, either getting to a difference of 20 victory points between the players, or getting to DEFCON 1, like getting, like, the war is so dramatic that you kind of created a nuclear war and then the game's over. Whoever does that loses the game immediately, or having full control over Europe. Like, if you ever have complete dominance in Europe, which was like maybe the main place where like a lot of like the Cold War actually happened, thematically, that's also like a victory condition. Now, the only way I have won this game or I have seen this game ending is either with the 20 victory points difference, which maybe shows a little bit of the not understanding the game that much because we didn't go until the very end, the 10th round, or by somebody accidentally triggering the DEFCON 1. It's like whoever's turn is it that goes to DEFCON 1, then that person loses, even if the other player is the one that made the game go to DEFCON 1, which is like kind of like an interesting mechanism. The game basically is you're just playing cards. And the interesting thing about this game that I've never seen before is that cards are either related to the US, related to the USSR, or related to both players. So if you are playing the card for its event, like the card has like number of operation points, or which is like in a little star, which signifies the color, which signifies whose card is it. And then on the bottom, it has the event.
Give us an example of an event.
I don't have it off the top of my head, like exactly, because they were going to be like, oh, that's not a three big. But let's say that the more powerful the event, the more value that operation points have. And operation points allow you to do different things. They allow you to put influence on a country. They allow you to try to attempt to remove influence from your enemy in that country. They allow you to attempt like a coup or a military operation in that country. Or they allow you to like kind of play it for rolling a die to see if you can go into the space race and advance on that little track. It's very hard to think because I played the game in Mexico and I bought it in Spanish. So like how does all of these things translate into English? I've never played the game in English. But the stronger or the more operation points that the card has, the more things you can do. So like if you're attempting influence, if the card has four, then you're adding four, in essence, four influence of your own in countries that you have already influenced that are attached to places where you already have influence. But also the event of that card will be more powerful, will be more devastating, will be more beneficial either for you or more detrimental to your opponent. And now here's the interesting twist. If I am the US and I have a card that has a lot of operation points, but is related to the USSR, if I play that card for the four operation points that it would give me, the USSR, my enemy, basically, is allowed to trigger that event. And basically, that event will be beneficial for the USSR. And that is like the juicy part of this game is where like, ha, I have this card that is really powerful. I want to do a lot of things, but I don't want to trigger the event for my enemy. There are ways that, okay, I'll use this card then on the space race so they don't have to do it. There are cards that allow you to negate the event for the opponent. But in general, you want to play events that are yours and you don't want to play cards that are related to events of your enemy, unless they're very weak. But at the same time, you cannot be scared of using those operation points, because otherwise then you're like, yes, you're giving something to your enemy, but like, how can you use those operation points in the most efficient way so that, let's say that the card is like the USSR is able to put 4 influence points in South America. And I'm like, I really don't want to give those influence points to Jonas. But at the same time, if I use this card and it gives me these 4 influence points, then I can put this influence in Europe or in somewhere else. So it's like, I think that's a very interesting like kind of decision-making points. And I think that's where like very, very good players that know the game very well, which I'm not one of them, are able to see like, okay, yeah, this card, you can use it at the beginning of the game. Like this event is it's not going to do that much damage. And at the same time, people that know really well the game can be like, oh, this card hasn't come up. I know that it's going to come up, and that's where there's the coup in Cuba. And then that means that if I put influence as the US in Cuba, at some point Jonas can play this card and it removes all my influence in Cuba because it's the revolution of Cuba. And then then you get your influence. And all of these things are super good. So I did a terrible job at explaining the game, but in general, you're just playing cards and either using the event or the operation power for them. And it's a still very interesting game. Very a lot of decision points, a lot of countries where you can put influence, where you need to be seeing like what people, what your opponent is doing, how much influence, how are you going to score, when you're going to score, because there's also these scoring cards that you can trigger at any point if you have it in your hand.
Well, you say any point, but those do not happen like at any random moment of the game.
No.
Like,
you choose. If you have the scoring of Europe in your hand, then you choose when you're going
to
play it.
Yeah, and in addition to that, Europe scoring happens in a certain part of the game, right? And the Southeast Asia scoring happens in a certain part of the game.
Yes.
They are a little bit of timed, right?
Yes, they are a little bit timed. So some scoring cards are only on the first phase of the game, which is rounds 1 to 3. Some scoring cards are second phase with round 4 to 7. And some scoring cards are in the last 3 rounds. You need to know those things. That those are things that you need to be considering. But you also don't know like, okay, so is my opponent having this card right now? Did it came out? Should I put influence in Europe? Or should I not care about Europe and focus in Southeast Asia for now? Because that's a trigger. And again, if you have the card in your hand, then that's fantastic because you can start putting influence where it matters. But if you don't have it in your hand, then you don't know. You're like, you can kind of have to play with what you have, especially not knowing the game that well as I did. I don't think we ever reached the 4 games that we played. We ever reached the third age or the third part of the war, which again, maybe signifies how bad we are at this game, me and my dad. But at the same time, what I wanted to review is like, is this game fun? Is this game worth exploring and investing? Like every single game that we had, regardless of how long it took us, some of them were a little bit shorter, some of them were a little bit longer, we had fun. And we kind of were willing and wanting to play again. Not immediately, because sometimes it took a little bit more time to get into the game and to make decisions. I think it's worth all the hype that it has. I don't know, if, for example, if it's a game that I would be willing to play all the time here in Finland, where I have like the big collection, where I have many other options to choose from. Will I want to invest like 4 hours of my time regularly to get to know this game deeply? I'm like, no, but maybe if like I was playing online async or something like that, that is something that I could definitely do, though I'm not an online gamer. And every now and then I would be willing to play this game if we get it from the library or something. Like, I think that would be worth doing. Now it's in Mexico and it's stay there because it's in Spanish and it's a game that I would like to play with my dad more often. And that's great because I have barely any collection there. So it's like, yeah, let's just spend time with my dad talking about stuff and playing the game. So that was a great buy for that particular thing. But I do understand where people that love this game are coming from. Yeah, Twilight Struggle, a good game. That is my take. What do you think? You have played it online, right?
I have played Twilight Struggle once with a friend of mine. We played it in the Meet space, not online. So I feel like when people talk about the game and when you talked about the game, it sounds very intimidating because the strategy is so much happening in the cards and you need to know what cards are there and when does the scoring happen. But even on the first play I had, without knowing any of the cards that I'm going to see, I still had a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Because the theme, I mean, like, if you know a little bit about the history of the Cold War and what happened in the 1900s after Second World War, you can like guess what is going to happen, what type of events you will see throughout the game. You will know when there will be more division in Europe and when there will be less. You said that, well, Cold War happened mostly in Europe, but I think this game teaches you well that there was actually many theaters of war regarding the Cold War.
Yeah, I did not say that about it happened in Europe, more like that if you influence the whole of Europe, then you win thematically. That makes sense. Like,
yes, absolutely.
So, by the way, I think the counterpart to that is like, it teaches me a lot of events that I didn't know about. Like, and then I went and Googled some of these events. I'm like, okay, because it was an event related to the USSR and it said X, Y, or Z. I was like, I didn't know that even happened. So that was also really interesting. So if somebody that is interested in history, definitely I can see them enjoying this game.
Yeah, and same here. Yeah.
I think that's partly also why my dad enjoyed a lot, or more than maybe he would a game of this weight.
So Twilight Struggle, it is a heavy game. How much does your dad play games? Was this like a big step up in terms of weight?
Yes, I think had the theme not been there, I don't think I would have been able to convince him to play it. I think the mechanics, as you say, they sound intimidating, but they're not. It's mostly about the events and how it's played. So I think the weight comes more in the decision-making space and knowing the cards rather than the mechanics of the game. But that might still be weighty enough for somebody that is not such a big board gamer as my dad not to have enjoyed it, but the theme helped him enjoy it. And that's Twilight Struggle.
I have been playing All Bridges Burning, or All Bridges Burning, Red Revolt, and White Guard in Finland, 1917 to 1918. All Bridges Burning is the 10th volume in the COIN series by GMT. COIN is an acronym and not, you know, a money coin like I thought when I first heard the term. COIN stands for Counterinsurgency, and the original game system is designed by Volko Runki, who himself is a former CIA analyst and used to run and design games for CIA and the US military. The COIN games usually take place in real-world, multi-sided conflicts, and All Bridges Burning is no different. The game is centered around the Finnish Civil War that took place in 1918 before the end of the First World War. All Bridges Burning is primarily a three-player game. The Civil War itself is usually seen as a conflict between the Reds and the Whites, or the Communists and the Anti-Communists, but the designer Vesa Arponen has added a third faction to the conflict, the non-violent Social Democrats, or the Moderates. There are also Russian forces that help the Reds and German forces that help the Whites, but Russian and German troops aren't owned by any of the players. The game plays in two phases. The first phase is the setup to the war, and the second phase, the actual war itself. There's also a bit of an epilogue to the game, as the game can end in none of the factions winning, but Finland becoming a German or a Russian vassal state. This can happen if the game end is triggered, but the conflict track is too high compared to the presence of German or Russian troops in Finland. All Bridges Burning was the very first COIN game I played. I've always been curious about the series because of the historical settings and the asymmetrical factions, but I honestly had no idea how they play in practice. One thing I have often heard people say is that Root by Cole Worley is a kind of a COIN game, or a COIN game that's actually fun, and there's way more people who have played Root than COIN games. So I thought that we could talk about All Bridges Burning by comparing it to something more familiar, which in this case is Root. If you do not know what Root is, let me give you a very quick description. In Root, ideally, four players play highly asymmetric factions of woodland critters fighting for dominance. The base factions of Root are Marquis de Cat, who have tons of troops. They need to build a map full of buildings that are the fuel to their economy. Then you have the Eerie, or the Birds, who also have a lot of troops. As Eerie, you add one more action to the sequence of actions you are executing, and if you cannot execute all of your actions in one turn, you need to reset your actions fully. You have the Alliance, who are the bunnies and mice and all other types of woodland animals. The Alliance is basically playing guerrilla warfare against the Cats and Eerie. Finally, there is the raccoon Vagabond, who has only one piece that moves around the board, trading with other players and trying to sneak in a victory in the midst of all the fighting. Louis, what do you feel is the biggest difference between Root and All Bridges Burning?
It felt that Root's asymmetry plays more into how you actually play the game for Root. At least, I think both the Reds and the Whites, even though they play somewhat different, they have like similar objectives and similar ways of doing things. Where in Root, I think the asymmetry is more like you're playing a different minigame with every faction. Yeah.
The factions in Root do feel like you're playing like four different types of area control game together, which is really cool. Or at least the first time I played Root, it just was a completely novel thing for me. And as you said, in All Bridges Burning, the factions, they feel mechanically very similar. The Reds and the Whites, they have the same basic actions. The asymmetry comes more about where they are located and the event deck. So in All Bridges Burning and in all coin games, you have this event deck. Every round, one event is flipped over. There's some historical thing that has happened. And then one of the factions can choose to execute it. There's usually, of course, like something positive for someone or something very bad for some faction. However, I do still think that All Bridges Burning will end up feeling very different depending which faction you are playing. I have now played all the three different factions, Reds, Whites, and Moderates. You have played Reds.
I have played Reds, yes. Yeah.
So as the Reds, kind of like what happened in real life, you are getting steamrolled by the German troops, first getting a lot of land for yourself and then losing it little by little. Whites, you just are very focused on the warfare. But as the Moderates, it turns into a game of negotiation, or at least it turned for me when I played the Moderates, trying to kind of like find the balance between the Whites and the Reds so that none of them would win, but also making sure that, you know, Finland does not end up being a vassal state for Germany or Russia.
Yeah.
What about the interaction in Root and All Bridges Burning? Do you see any big differences there?
Yes. I think All Bridges Burning has more interaction, more immediate, like you're fighting more for places, whereas with Root, you might not need to interact until towards the end of the game when somebody you see like, oh, somebody's winning. I think that really depends on who you're playing with. But in general, it feels like All Bridges Burning is more aggressive in general. You have to be attacking your opponent, especially if you're one of the two factions. And maybe if you're the Moderates, you have to be interacting with people in order to get what you want.
Yep. I mean, there is interaction in Root. You do kind of battle a little bit. You don't necessarily see those like big dramatic battles in the beginning or the middle of the game. They usually end up happening in the end. Or there might be like the reason why there is a battle is that someone is blocking an area that another player needs to get to. And they, because of that, there's a battle. Yeah. However, in All Bridges Burning, you are really looking into that like all the time. Like, okay, if you're playing the Reds, you're really looking into Whites. What are they doing? Are they getting cannons? Are they getting those Jaegers that are going to drive the trains to Tampere and kill all of my troops? And as the Moderates, you're looking at both sides.
Mm-hmm.
How are they preparing for the war? Is another player getting a too big of an advantage?
Mm.
There's also the interesting thing with All Bridges Burning. And I, to my understanding, this is a shared mechanic in most of the coin games, is that you have this like sequence of actions. So whoever gets to go first gets to pick one action. And that action is kind of like locked away from other players, meaning that there is that event card. Only one player gets to execute that event card.
Mm.
None of the other players get to. Then you have this like extremely powerful action, which means that, well, you cannot take an action next turn, but now you get to make this big action. Only one player gets to do that.
Mm.
And then usually if you go last, you take the action that is remaining. Now, this is another point of interaction, right? Because if you see that there's a very good event card coming for Lewis, I might block you, which means that, well, on this turn, I might want to pass, so I get to go first in the next turn in order to prevent Lewis from taking that card.
Yeah, that is true. I think that's very relevant. Like here, you're choosing actions first, which determines what you can do or what you can do last, like next turn. I think you have to plan maybe 2-3 turns ahead, or at least one turn ahead, where in Root is more freeform. Like it's, I think, more forgiving if you even make a mistake.
Absolutely. How do you feel about the funness of the game? Which one is more fun to play, Root or All Bridges Burning?
I've only played All Bridges Burning once while I played Root more than 15 times, I think. I would say Root is easier to get to the table and maybe in general easier to adopt and have fun with people. However, I think if people like coin games or are into this theme, for sure somebody that is interested, like a group of friends that are playing All Bridges Burning, can probably have more fun with it while knowing the game. But Root, I would say Root.
Yeah, I agree with you. Like Root, the game feels just inherently more fun. And I, after playing all bridges burning. I get why people say that Root is a coin game that's fun. I definitely do not agree that Root is a coin game, but I agree that Root is a lot of fun. And I think it will be fun for many players. The whole idea of the asymmetric factions, hey, that's just inherently fun. You're like solving your little puzzle. Next time you play the game, you're kind of like figuring out like, okay, what should I do different this time? You know, what is my faction now? Well, how does this faction play? So there's a lot of discovery in terms of mechanics. All Bridges Burning, the first game I played, I did not play it with you. It was one of the most painful game sessions I have ever had. After that session, I thought to myself that coin is not for me. Too much work for a very little theme, for very little fun. The victory conditions in All Bridges Burning are very easy to understand. So there's no kind of like trip ups there. But the different actions that the factions take, they're not easy to pick up and remember. So you're like always kind of like referring to the player reference of like, okay, how does this thing execute? Then you have these propaganda phases, which is also, to my understanding, typical for coin games. The propaganda phases are all almost like these intermissions in the game where you do a little bit of kind of like scoring, gaining more resources, gaining income, changing the layout of the map a little bit. And the propaganda phase in its own is like a full beast with all of these different stages and mechanics that happen there. Even after playing for the first time of the game, I could not tell you like what are all the stages that happen there. I played it now 3 times. I still couldn't tell you how every action works. Which one are you now more excited to play next, Root or All Bridges Burning?
That's an interesting question because I kind of want to play All Bridges Burning just because I want to, like I have the same feeling as you after the first time. Obviously, when I played the first time, it was your second time and I think we were better prepared to deal with the heaviness of the game. But I still didn't love the session. But I would like to play it again to see, to kind of figure out like, yeah, is this something for me or not at all? So that's the only reason why maybe like if somebody suggests this and we're 3 people versus like maybe getting a 4th player and Root, I would go for this one at this point. But in general, if we were in the board game meetup and somebody said Root or All Bridges Burning and you have a lot of people that could play, maybe Root?
Yeah, absolutely. For me, I think I'm much more excited to play All Bridges Burning as my next game compared to Root. Again, I played Root also plenty of times. So a lot of the novelty of Root has kind of worn off. But in Root, when I think about my next game, I usually think about, well, how should I optimize the economies of the different factions? You know, if I play the cats, what should I do different this time? And how should I defend from the other factions? And also I'm thinking, well, how should I hurt the Eerie next time or any of the new expansion factions? But whereas I think about what my next game of All Bridges Burning might look like, I'm thinking about what will happen in the game, meaning that, okay, where are the Germans going to land? You know, which cities will be the toughest to conquer? And then, you know, will the Reds be able to use the Russians effectively? Mm-hmm. It's much easier said than done. So I'm really looking forward to see what will happen in the game and less of like, which faction will I play and how will I play it better next time? I'm just like really interested in the story and the alternative history that's going to play out.
Do you think you're going to get burned? Like, do you think this is going to be a feeling that you like have forever or is something that maybe in 2-3 plays, it's gone and you don't want to play All Bridges Burning?
I'm going to talk a little bit about new content. So in Root, there are expansion factions. So, you know, if you get tired of Root, you can bring in new factions and learn how those factions work. All Bridges Burning is the 10th volume in the coin series. There are a lot of other coin games. And I'm now extremely curious to try out those games. Because a new coin game to me means, well, there's new history for me to learn. And then seeing like new dynamics happen on the board. I'm not so much interested in seeing like, okay, what new mechanics will the different games bring in, but more about like, okay, what will the power struggle look like on the board? And because of that, I cannot see myself now getting burned out of the coin games. But I'm also not looking forward to like playing All Bridges Burning week after week, but instead maybe try Fire in the Lake next, Cuba Libre next, or any of the other more popular coin games.
Yeah, that's definitely true. Like when you asked me the question, like which one do you want to play first? Next, I was going to answer neither, Cuba Libre. I'm now looking forward to play Cuba Libre. So I think I'm in the same idea. I don't think All Bridges Burning is a game that I could play forever. I think maybe a couple more times, unless I really get hooked. But I think after playing maybe all the factions once, I would be like, okay, this is not necessarily a game for me. That's why I want to try Cuba Libre, because they also say it's the easier coin game to get into and understand the different mechanics and how it plays and the power struggles. So I definitely want to try that one.
Yep. GMT has also released this new series of coin games that are not actually called coin games, but I think they are called ICS. ICS, Irregular Conflicts Series. So they're kind of like coin games, but a little more stripped down. So if you want something lighter in terms of mechanics, there's that. However, now going through the struggle of learning kind of like a full coin game, and to my understanding, All Bridges Burning is also not considered to be the easiest coin game to learn. I'm like, Koopa Libre doesn't seem like a challenge to me. Learning Fire in the Lake, hey, I can do it now.
Yeah, you started with the hardest and going down from there. I'm not saying that's hard, so I have no clue. Actually, you can see with these games, like, or at least playing All Bridges Burning and seeing how it plays and develops, and even with Twilight Struggle, which is also a GMT game, how definitely this can be considered like a part of the hobby, but at the same time, a hobby in and of itself. Like if you're a history gamer or a war gamer and you're going heavy into these type of games, for sure you can get lost in all the complexities. And if you're not, for sure, like the theming or the mechanics or even like the graphic design of the games can put you off. Like, yeah, this doesn't look that pretty. Like, you know, this looks more like a...
Well, you say that, but I think the cover of the game is gorgeous. And I think the map, it's good. It's not an ugly map.
No, but it's too white and like everything
it's,
is like
no,
too...
it's thematic, Louis.
No, I know. No, I mean, yes, but like I can see how somebody that is more interested in like flashier games, newer games can be like, this is not for me.
Absolutely.
And I kind of, I'm like that, but I try to be like, not.
Yeah.
So I definitely, I'm like, hey, I need to push to play more All Bridges Burning, to play Koopa Libre, which is the easiest, maybe one of these games from the new series. How did you call that series again?
ICS.
ICS.
Irregular Conflict Series.
Irregular Conflict Series. I'm like now looking forward to finding out more about that.
Let me address a couple of the common criticisms people have for All Bridges Burning. One point of criticism people have is that the moderates are boring to play. They don't get to participate in the fighting. So it really depends on the player whether you will find the moderates fun. I approached the moderates as this balancing power, and I did a lot of negotiating around the event cards that came up. And that was a lot of fun. In All Bridges Burning, you can trade resources to kind of like make these binding or non-binding deals. I don't even remember if they were binding or non-binding. Then another point of criticism people have that moderates are overpowered. There is an official suggestion by the designer to change the victory point margin calculation for the moderates, which does make things a lot harder for the moderates. And all of the three games that I played, we played with this official variant. And I would suggest everyone else to also play with this variant. The designer also advocates for this variant. Third criticism you can hear for All Bridges Burning is that the first phase itself is boring. In the first phase, you're just kind of like preparing for war. No conflict is happening yet. But to me, the first phase is so tense. After the first game, it is so interesting to see how the whites and reds prepare for the unavoidable war. And the Red Revolt event that will kick things off is very exciting because there's a chance for the reds to really start strong if the whites have not been careful with their unit placements.
Where did you get these criticisms from?
Board Game Geek. I read some of the comments. I think the Space Biff review addressed some of these things. Louis, if we think about our fantasy collection, would you add Root to the fantasy collection?
No.
You would not?
I don't own Root.
Uh-huh.
I think it's partly because there's other people that own it in our gaming group. But I think partly is like because I'm not convinced that it's a great game. I like it, but at the same time, like I feel that what other people say, like when somebody's winning, everybody gangs up on them. And like I think the game has some flaws that I haven't really dig deep into to in order to figure out like, do I love this game? Would I add it to the fantasy collection or not? So if you ask me right now, would I add Root to the fantasy collection? My answer would be no, because I don't think it should be there, but I'm not sure.
I would have added it. I do not own it either because, yes, there are multiple copies of Root in our game groups. I enjoy Root every time I play it. It's not necessarily now the game that I look most forward to, but I do think it's one of the best area control games there are. I do agree with your point about this bashing the leader. You know, someone gets ahead and now we try to bring that player down. But I feel that this happens in the beginner games. Once you kind of see this dynamic happen, what you end up doing is you just try to like stay there for the second or the third position, try to build up for that big final move. Mm-hmm. So you kind of like see more of this more subtle maneuvering with more experienced players.
Yeah, and maybe I've had 5 of those games ever where there's not at least one person that is newbie. And then either people are like taking advantage, or they're like just playing so randomly that it kind of breaks the game, or they're like not playing really well to block somebody else. And I think because of that, it's like I haven't had the chance to really enjoy Root maybe as you have. So that's why.
I'm not going to ask you whether you would add All Bridges Burning or Coin Games into our fantasy collection, because you have only played it once.
Mm.
And I feel that you need to have like more experience even with this game or with another coin game to make that decision.
Would you?
Would I add? Yeah, absolutely. Or I would maybe add a coin game. So maybe every month or every quarter, I would kind of rotate that coin game to a different coin game.
See, and this is your own doing, Jonas. Like, you limited our fantasy collection to a specific number of games. If you hadn't, then I would be like, sure, Root, maybe. But since the fantasy collection is limited, I don't think there's space to add these games. Like, I think there's other games that should be added there, and Root is not one of them. But if our fantasy collection could be 200 games, then for sure Root would be one of the 200 games that I would add.
You know, if we could add every game, then it wouldn't even matter which games do we add. But I'm not sad about All Bridges Burning or Coin Games not getting into the fantasy collection, because I am certain that we will end up playing Koopa Libre or other coin games. Mm. So I think we will return to this topic. Before we get to the topic of the episode, I want to give a shout out to Manuel, who has been writing us Spotify comments. Manuel, I see those comments. I have replied to them. I know I reply a little late, but I'm very happy to see them every time. The second thing I want to mention is that if you listen to the last episode, you know that me and Luis are having this bet on the Golden Geek Awards. Luis, did you know that the OP publisher of Flip 7, which you guessed to be the party game of the year, had a free giveaway of Flip 7 games to boost the votes for Flip 7 for the best party game of the year?
I did not know that. That is news to me, and I'm happy about.
It is going to be very exciting to see whether the OP managed to turn the boat, because I do feel that the gang was still maybe the better choice for the party game. Let's see.
Let's see. Exciting. I'm going to win this bet.
Let's get to the topic of the episode, tariff apocalypse. USA and China are currently in a tariff war, which has a big impact on business all around the world, including our little hobby of board gaming, since a lot of board games are designed and sold in the US, and a lot of board games are manufactured in China. Before we get to the impact of these tariffs on European publishers and gamers, let's go through some tariff facts. And by the way, we won't get political in this podcast. We will just be discussing the impacts these tariffs have. And another thing I do want to mention is that this is a board gaming podcast. We will be talking about board games. There are much more bigger things, more important things happening in the world that these tariffs impact. However, hey, this is a space to discuss board games. So that because of that, we're just going to be talking about that little small part of the world. Luis, do you know how much are the new tariffs for board games?
For board games in particular?
For board games in particular.
I do not know, but I stayed at 154% for
that
China.
That is correct. Yeah, 145 for toys. So there has been this big number of 245% going around. It's not for toys. So board games are under the toys category. And for board games, the current tariffs are 145%. Do you know how much the tariffs used to be before this year?
10%.
Zero. There used to be no tariffs for board games, at least according to my research.
Yeah.
Luis, if you have games on the sea at this moment, before the new tariffs were announced, what will be the tariff for those games?
Well, it has to be 145, right?
So I tried to look into this because I heard publishers being nervous about having games on boats as these new tariffs were announced. But what I learned, or my understanding is, that the tariff gets calculated when your goods get loaded onto the boat.
Okay.
So if your games are sailing on the sea and then the new tariffs get announced, In my understanding, then those new tariffs do not apply. So there is a tiny bit of grace period.
Okay.
But if you have your games being manufactured or staying in a warehouse in China and now you're shipping them to the US, then it is the tariff that it is applicable at that moment. That is going to have to be paid for those games.
Got it.
Who pays the tariff, Luis? Manufacturer or the publisher?
I think in general, it should be the publisher, whoever is importing the goods into the country.
That is true. So the most common agreement is that the publisher pays the tariff, meaning that it's a bigger financial burden for the publisher, or at least the direct burden is for the publisher. Of course, it's going to impact the printers as well, but more like in an indirect way. Luis, is it possible for US publishers to switch to domestic manufacturing?
This one I know, because this one I've read a lot. And unfortunately, apparently, for sure it's possible in the long run. But the problem is that currently, apparently, the technology or the factories to manufacture in the same way and capacity as in China does not exist at this moment. So yes, it's possible in the future if someone invests in creating those factories in the US.
My understanding is also that, you know, for hobby game print runs, so we're not talking about like mass scale of printing, the quality control is worse in the US manufacturing sector for board games. And the price itself can also be easily four times what publishers pay for Chinese manufacturing. So ending up in this situation where you pay four times more and get twice the quality that you used to get.
Yeah. I heard that there is some card producers, just card, that can be like they have the technology and the quality in the same way, but no cardboard, no plastic, no wood coating material. Cards might be.
Cards might be. And yeah, like things like double layered cardboard, no chance. One thing I was surprised to learn that is very difficult to manufacture in the US is the box itself.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So according to Jamie Steckmeyer of Stormwire Games, you need like three different machines to make that one cardboard box for a board game, like a quality cardboard box.
Okay.
So the next time you encounter a very flimsy board game box, which I have encountered and I've scoffed at them, I should remind myself that, hey, you know what? It's not easy to make a quality board game box.
Yeah, I think actually when I go back to Mexico, there's a couple of traditional Mexican board games, which I think are produced in Mexico. But then you see the quality of some of the components and you're like, ah, why don't they have better quality? And like, okay, maybe they don't have the factory. And that's also okay because we are supporting Mexican manufacturing.
With these 145% tariffs, which will be the better sales channel for publishers, retail or Kickstarter?
I don't know. I would say maybe Kickstarter.
You are right. The answer is Kickstarter. And the reason is that publishers have to sell the game at a discount to retailers so that they can make a profit. And this discount is a percentage of the price customers like us end up seeing. So if the price of the game is $50, I might sell it to the retailer for $20. This would be a 60% discount, which seems to be fairly common in the industry. If it costs $10 to manufacture a game, I have a margin of $10 if I sell it for $20. With the new tariffs, my $10 cost is now roughly $25. So if I want to keep my same $10 margin, I need to sell the game for the retailer for $35, right? If this would still be the 60% discount, the retailer then needs to sell the game for over $85. So the old price is $50, and then the new price ends up being more than $85, even though the cost went up only by $15. Now, if I sell my games directly to consumers via Kickstarter, I don't need to do these discounts for retailers. If I want to keep the same absolute margin, I need to increase the final sales price by $15. However, people don't seem to be that excited to back games at the moment, right? If you do the math, it seems that the Kickstarter is the better option. But every person I've talked to, they all seem to be pulling their pledges from Kickstarter or saying that they're not going to pledge a single Kickstarter because they don't know what will happen with these tariffs.
Yeah, and I think that's the main problem. Like, we have already been burned, or people have been burned with Kickstarter, even without the tariffs, by like prices going up or like by you having to pay more for shipping in some projects that are not planned that well. And now with these tariffs, it's like, what's going to happen? Like, will I have to pay three times the either the shipment or the tariffs or the tax costs. Yeah, for sure. I can understand why people are thinking that.
So, Luis, we live in Europe. Will the tariffs have an impact on us?
100%. And I think this is not necessarily a direct impact, but I think most people that I've read about have said that either half or the majority of their customers are in the US, and therefore that affects their sales, that affects their capacity of production, that affects a lot of things that if they were completely different sales channels, production channels and everything, it would maybe not affect necessarily Europe, besides the fact that it might affect some producers in China that will go down and then it would make things harder. But for sure, it's going to affect European consumers. Yeah. And then there might be some publishers trying to minimize the impact on US consumers will pass some of these costs into worldwide consumers where they might not have as high tariffs.
So the share of US sales for a publisher, it can easily be, depending of course on the publisher, be between 60 or 70%. So that means that the US market in itself can be a much more important market for the publisher than Europe or the rest of the world. And if publishers go out of business and if designers switch jobs, that's going to impact us, what we will see in the market as European gamers.
Yeah.
In addition to that, surviving publishers will probably want to take on less risky projects, which again, well, has an impact on what is being offered for us, the European gamers.
Yeah.
So, Luis, we are planning to go to Essen again this year. What do you expect from this year's Essen, given this tariff apocalypse?
I do not know, honestly, what's going to happen. Like, I think there has been so many, like, American publishers that are, like, the big players in the industry. I see that there's going to be less people, or at least less games, less being produced, less games being demoed, maybe a shortage of supply. And yeah, I don't really know what to expect.
So in terms of like, what do I look forward to as a gamer? I do not necessarily gravitate towards the plastic minis. So on that sector, personally, I'm not that worried that, oh, I don't get my big minis game this year. And last time we were in Essen, I was really going through the Japanese and the Korean publishers to see their little small games. So those publishers are not directly impacted by the tariff. So we might see those publishers in Essen, and therefore there might still be a lot of small gems for me to find at the fair. And then, of course, there's like a lot of German publishers in Essen, and those publishers have the biggest presence. Oh, CGE. That's not a German publisher, that's a Czech publisher, but they also have like a very big presence.
Yeah, but at the same time, all of these people are so impacted by the reduced or the higher prices in the United States that their business is for sure going to suffer. I don't know, maybe there are a lot of publishers are going to be like, hey, let's just import things to Europe and let's sell it at Essen. So then we're just going to have a lot of, on the other hand, a lot of supply there, a lot of board games, and maybe a lot of US consumers or a lot of US people just coming to buy their games here. Yeah. Of course, that's just ridiculous. But
if I think about the board game industry, we have, or for some, board game publishing is a business that makes money.
Mm-hmm.
For some, it is a side hustle that makes some money, but it's a side job.
Mm-hmm.
For some, it's a hobby. Mm-hmm. Doesn't really make any meaningful amount of money. And for some, it is an expensive hobby where you end up kind of like losing money to be able to make your games. If you're running a business, having less sales means now most of the time, layoffs, right? Which in turn probably means less games being produced. If you have a side hustle, you might choose to stop doing what you're doing if you can't bring in that extra income. If you are doing board game publishing as a hobby, you might also stop before it ends up becoming an expensive hobby, right? And if you're doing an expensive hobby, well, this is probably the point where you have to close shop for good. GMT is one of the publishers who have kind of like shared a little bit about the impact that these tariffs have on their business. And today we reviewed two GMT games. So according to GMT, they need to print over 25 games per year in order to run a healthy business.
Mm-hmm.
So 25 different titles. 14 titles are currently in printing. And the cost of those print runs is around $500,000.
Mm-hmm.
So with this new 145% tariff, the cost is going to be $1.2 million USD. So that's extra $700K for basically nothing as a company. So as a player, as a gamer who is like looking forward to diving into the coin series, maybe looking forward to see new coin games, or new games in this irregular conflict series, I'm a little bit worried about whether GMT is going to be able to weather storms like these.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. I think we're going to see a lot of companies not producing a lot of games, a lot of new games. And at the same time, maybe this will generate a lot of new talent in Europe and then shift some of the design teams and other stuff to Europe. So I don't know what's going to happen.
Let's talk about the possible silver linings that a dramatic event like this can cause in the industry. You mentioned the talent. To me, my thoughts go immediately to the components arm race and just in general seeing less plastic heavy productions.
Yeah.
Smaller boxes maybe.
Yeah.
Also, which I personally prefer with my limited shelf space.
Yeah, for sure. Maybe this is going to focus on quality rather than quantity, rather than flashiness. So maybe less heavy, less flashy Kickstarters even. Games that are better, maybe, like, I don't know, like...
Well, you can't put the component first anymore if you cannot produce that quality component, right?
Correct.
The tariffs can result into a full-blown recession, right?
Yeah.
All around the world. And then a lot of people say that, well, board games are not a necessity, meaning that that's like the one area where people will cut their spending.
Yeah.
However, I kind of like looked into this, like how recession-proof are board games?
Mm-hmm.
So it's not necessarily always so that you will cut entertainment first.
Yeah.
What you will end up doing is you will end up cutting the expensive entertainment first.
Yeah.
So you need to think about like, okay, are board games cheaper compared to out-of-home entertainment, such as like going to the movies, going to the theater, going to escape rooms?
Mm-hmm.
Things like that. And then, of course, playing a game by itself doesn't cost as much. Buying a big Kickstarter with 300 minis costs a lot.
Yeah.
Playing a game that you already have, well, that's a $0 cost if you do it at home.
Yeah. Have you ever checked or seen what's the demographic of hobby board gamers?
No.
Because I tend to think that they are, in general, people that have a lot of disposable income.
Mm-hmm.
Like, obviously, there's many different people, but it's like people that we don't need 200 games, and yet we still have 200 games. You don't need 50 games, and yet you still have 50 games. Mm-hmm. Like, so I think it's people that in general have disposable income that might still be able to use that disposable income for some board games. Maybe not as much as before, maybe not following the hype, but for sure, like, it's not going to destroy the board game industry, but I think it's going to definitely disrupt the board game industry. We had talked a lot, not in the podcast maybe, but we have talked about whether or not there's a bubble in the board game industry. I think for sure this is going to burst that bubble, maybe faster or sooner than it would be, and maybe for different reasons. But it might be that a lot of people, a lot of companies are like getting out of the industry, unfortunately, and some really good ones, but some that maybe are like more flashy and not so much content are also going to leave. And that might end up being good or bad. I don't know, but
yeah,
for sure bursting a bubble.
The bad thing with this bursting a bubble is that we unfortunately do not get to decide which companies go out of business. So we cannot decide that, okay, our favorite companies stay in business and the ones that we don't care that much go out of business. And by the way, of course, I do not wish anyone to go out of business. I understand that is like an extremely traumatic effect that will impact families and, you know, personal health, just to mention a couple of things.
Yeah.
However, of course, if I'm thinking this from a selfish personal standpoint, I have my favorite publishers that I'm more indifferent about.
Yeah, and another bad thing could be, now that you mentioned publishers, is that the big players, the big players that are consuming the industry and becoming monopolies and getting all the power and influence might keep growing and might absorb some other smaller companies that otherwise would go out of business. So that's not necessarily a bad thing, but I don't think that's necessarily a good shift for the industry to have less people making decisions.
Luis, final personal selfish worry about the tariffs relating to your board gaming experience.
Board games are going to become more expensive and therefore less board games in general that we can buy, regardless of whether or not there's recession or not, which would be terrible for everyone, not just because of board games. That's one thing. And the second personal worry, the Queen's Dilemma might never come. And I'm really looking forward to playing that game. We have been waiting for that Kickstarter. I think it was still already on production, but I don't know how this is going to affect the delivery of that particular Kickstarter. So sad.
My personal selfish worry is that PAX Renaissance second edition is not going to see that reprint.
Yeah.
Or, hey, maybe the Ion Games, the publisher, might even go out of business and I never get to have my physical copy of the game. We wish the best for everyone and we want to thank you for your time. Our next episode will air in 2 weeks. In the meantime, you can visit boardgameok.com for more information about the show.
Bye-bye, okay.